Welcome to Good Fellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by an unrestricted educational grant from Mercy Ascot. The content of this podcast was developed independently and the views expressed are those of our expert speaker. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler and today I welcome to the podcast Dr. Nick Lilick. Today we are discussing the patient with a blocked nose. Nick is a New Zealand-trained specialist otolaryngologist, head and neck surgeon who grew up in Auckland. After graduating from the University of Auckland, he completed surgical training and was awarded Fellowship of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. He then undertook fellowship training in Edinburgh in head and neck, oncological and thyroid surgery. He also attained a Master's of Science from the University of London. Following this, he completed fellowship in Auckland, developing expertise in treatment and reconstruction of advanced skin cancer, thyroid cancer, and cancers of the oral cavity, sinonasal cavity, and throat. Nick is a consultant surgeon at Auckland City Hospital and North Shore Hospital. He is a lecturer at the University of Auckland. He works privately in Auckland and operates out of Mercy Ascot. Kia ora, Nick, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So today we're discussing blocked and congested noses. These are common presentations to primary care, so it would be great today to discuss how we start thinking about these consultations. So Nick, when we're taking a history, what do we need to ask our patients to help us discover the cause of the blocked nose?
So I think in the history, it's important to recognize that patients don't often present in a straightforward manner. And there's two important issues here. Firstly, that adults and children will often present very differently. And secondly, patients will often present with symptoms that are not a blocked nose, but the blocked nose itself will be the underlying problem. So with children, we often see them presenting with snoring and sometimes more severe sleep disordered breathing, such as obstructive sleep apnea. And traditionally, we always thought that it was due to adenoids and tonsils, and often it is. However, a big proportion of patients will also have comorbid rhinitis, and failing to address this can lead to treatment failure. Other ways that children present include mouth breathing, and often parents will say that when they're concentrating, for example, watching TV, or when they're being read to, they sit there with their mouth open. They can present with rhinorrhea, so a constantly runny nose, drooling, particularly in younger children, and also in older children, malocclusion. And in particular, what we see is maxillary crowding, which can lead to dental and orthodontic problems. In adults, it's incredibly common in New Zealand that adults will have a symptom of postnasal drip or persistent worsening of the blocked nose after upper respiratory tract infection that does not settle down, facial fullness that can be associated with this blocked nose sensation, and then what can loosely be described as hay fever. And sometimes adult patients will not complain of a blocked nose, despite them having an objectively blocked nose. And the best analogy I have for this is if someone is born with a functioning unilateral eye and the other does not work, and you ask them at the age of 30 what their vision is like, they will tell you their vision is normal because that's what they're used to. And this is something similar that happens with nasal obstruction, where patients are used to the limited airflow in their nose, and so they don't feel it as a symptom. So that's how I would say patients commonly present. And getting to the underlying diagnosis can be pretty tricky because a lot of the diagnoses will have similar symptoms. The important factor to identify and exclude are neoplastic causes, which are very rare. However, they're very important differentials. And so the red flag symptoms for neoplasms include recurrent epistaxis, usually associated with unilateral nasal obstruction, not bilateral, unilateral tardive medial effusion, and neck lumps. And it's particularly important to be mindful of this in the Southeast Asian and Pacifica patients who have the highest rates of nasopharyngeal carcinoma in the world. I think it's important to note that the site of the obstruction can vary from hour to hour because there's a circadian rhythm to turbinate engorgement, and this is not unusual for patients to complain of. And in terms of other specific symptoms, hyposmia and facial discomfort, or sometimes fullness in the face, can often indicate underlying chronic sinusitis. However, it's important to note that facial pain and headaches by themselves rarely ever are due to sinusitis. They're more commonly due to atypical migraines or mid-facial pain syndromes. patients who have sinusitis will usually have nasal obstruction or rhinorrhea accompanying the facial discomfort or headaches. In allergic rhinitis, patients will often complain of an itchy nose, and they may have itchy eyes or runny eyes. And this is not the case in non-allergic rhinitis. A variant of rhinitis is vasomotor rhinitis, where patients will complain of a runny nose or nasal obstruction that is initiated by eating or a change in temperature. And apart from presenting symptoms, important comorbid disorders for rhinitis and sinusitis in particular include atopic illnesses, and particularly asthma. And a significant proportion of patients who present with rhinitis and sinusitis will have a subclinical asthma that has not been identified. I think these are the key factors in the presenting history.
Some great tips there. Thank you very much, Nick. So when we move on to our examination in primary care, what should we be examining and looking for?
I think while taking the history, you can glean a lot from the patient's mannerisms and what they're doing during the consultation. And this is often important for children. So with children, if they're sitting there or interacting with mostly their mouth open, it usually signifies a severe form of nasal obstruction. Nasal excoriation and rhinorrhea can also be present that you can see from the end of the bed. And in older children, malocclusion can also be sometimes noted as a sign of chronic nasal obstruction. In both adults and children, purple discoloration under the eyes can indicate chronic venous engorgement in the nose. And in terms of a more specific examination, I think having a very good headlight is paramount. And the reason for this is that otoscopes, which often people use to look in the nose, don't have a strong light and they don't free up your hands. And I think to work a nasal speculum well, you need to have free hands. An anterior rhinoscopy, my apologies, is a fancy term for shining a bright light in the nose. And the key finding will be seeing swollen and purple turbinates. And these can usually be seen laterally just within the nose and sometimes can be confused with polyps. But usually polyps are almost translucent and hang more medially, where the turbinates arise from the lateral side of the nose and are purple and swollen. Nasal septal deviation is very common and almost ubiquitous really in the population and is very rarely the sole cause of nasal obstruction. We will often see that as a comorbid problem. And in children, a good oral cavity exam, particularly paying attention to malocclusion and also the size of the tonsils, is important, as adenoid and tonsillar hypertrophy can lead to nasal obstruction in children.
And Nick, are there any special bedside tests we should be performing in primary care?
I think there are a number of things that get discussed in textbooks and so on, including holding a cold steel instrument under the nose to check for condensation. But I think the history and a good anterior rhinoscopy are much better than any bedside test.
Okay, thank you. So considering investigations now, are there any investigations we should be considering with our patient with a blocked nose? Thinking perhaps swabs, blood, skin prick testing, radiology, things like that.
So swabs don't really have a place in an obstructed nose unless it's an acute unilateral sinusitis, in which case it can be useful. But otherwise, there's no real role for swabs, as it's hardly ever an infective cause. Skin prick testing and RAS blood testing is relatively controversial. And I think my immunology colleagues may have a different opinion on this, but in my mind, there's only two situations where they're particularly useful in obtaining. Firstly, if the family has a dog or cat that they're happy to get rid of, then discovering an isolated allergy to either of those can be very useful to alleviate the symptoms. Secondly, if the patient or the family would consider immunotherapy. And it's important to know that immunotherapy is weekly injections or daily wafers for a number of years. And the problem is that immunotherapy is very useful if you have an isolated allergy. But in New Zealand, a lot of patients will have multiple allergies. And so other than in those two situations, knowing that the patient's allergic to dust mites or mold or pollen mix A or B isn't particularly useful when it comes to management, as it's impossible to avoid those allergens. Other tests that I consider important are a CT scan of the sinuses. And this is particularly for patients who have failed the trial of initial medical management. And the reason for that is to see whether the underlying problem is chronic sinusitis or isolated rhinitis. And we'll talk about that a bit more.
So, Nick, it's important to consider the different causes as this is going to direct our treatment. So I wonder if we can just talk about the clues that would help us make a diagnosis, perhaps starting with rhinitis.
So rhinitis, which is inflammation of the sinonasal mucosa without sinusitis, can be broadly divided into seasonal, which we often call hay fever, and perennial. Seasonal rhinitis or hay fever is usually short-lasting and typically responds well to short-term antihistamines and topical steroids. Perennial rhinitis is much more common, and up to about a third of the population in Auckland have it, and it's much more problematic to treat. Patients will often complain of nasal obstruction or post-nasal drip. And clinically, we see enlarged and inflamed turbinates. And in terms of rhinitis, and getting it drilling into that a little bit more, broadly speaking, if we also, so this is perennial rhinitis, can be divided into allergic, non-allergic, and vasomotor. But it's important to understand that allergic and non-allergic rhinitis make up the vast majority of cases.
Okay, and then moving on perhaps to sinusitis.
The best way to think of sinusitis in the chronic form is that it's a more severe form of rhinitis. So all patients who have chronic sinusitis will have evidence of rhinitis, but this is not true of the reverse. And I think that sinusitis as a diagnostic entity is widely misunderstood. So acute sinusitis often presents with unilateral nasal obstruction, pussy discharge, fevers, and some level of discomfort. And this is usually an infection that can be bacterial or viral. By far, the more common variant is chronic sinusitis. And the best way to think about chronic sinusitis is not as an infection, but as a form of asthma of the nose, because the underlying problem is actually the way the immune system behaves or interacts with inhaled particles and the bacteria that live inside the nose. The tricky bit is that chronic sinusitis can present and have identical examination findings to rhinitis, but basically represent a more severe form of the disease. And when polyps are present, we call this chronic sinusitis with polyposis. This represents an even more severe form of chronic sinusitis. And it's important to note that polyps are pretty difficult to see unless the disease is very severe, unless you have a flexible nasal endoscope. But that's how I would summarize sinusitis.
Excellent. And thinking about the third most common cause, nasal anatomy issues, nasal valve collapse or septal abnormalities.
And yes, and there are patients who have a nasal obstruction who do not have adenotonsillar hypertrophy, rhinitis, or sinusitis, but have either severe septal deviation or nasal valve collapse. However, this is much less common than disorders we have already discussed. And it's important to know that these disorders often coexist with the inflammatory disorders. So severe septal deviation, which can either be developmental or traumatic, usually causes persistent nasal obstruction, typically unilateral and typically not associated with any postnasal drip. Nasal valve collapse, which can be a sequelae of chronic nasal obstruction because of the persistent high negative pressure that patients have to produce to move air through the nose, can weaken the nasal cartilages over many years and cause nasal valve collapse. We typically see this being more common in European or Pakeha noses as the valves are more narrow at baseline. But in essence, nasal valve collapse is where the cartilage of the lateral nose that forms the structure of the external nose falls towards the septum and narrows the airway when the patient is breathing in. And this is due to the Venturi effect. And during an examination, this can be seen as the soft tissues of the alar, the tip of the nose, collapsing during inspiration.
Now, patients can also present with the sequelae of a blocked nose. So can we talk about what these are?
So we've discussed some of these already, but perhaps to summarize, sleep disorder breathing, which can vary from snoring to obstructive sleep apnea. And although snoring by itself can be what we call primary snoring in adults and not too worrying, in children we tend to think it always being associated with some form of sleep architecture disturbance. And then this can go on to have the sequelae of learning difficulty, concentration problems, behavioral issues, and cardiovascular health issues. Malocclusion and drooling are also possible sequelae. And during the COVID era, we have also seen some anxiety with blocked noses and rhinorrhea as patients then feel like they themselves and their children are often seen as being sick and therefore infective.
Great. So thinking about management now of the blocked nose, I wonder if we can start with conservative management that may be started in primary care. So thinking perhaps of decongestant drugs, anti-allergy measures, and others. Tell us about what we should be doing.
So in terms of some of the strategies that do not work that well, I would say decongestant drugs are one of the top ones. And look, they have a role in the acute phase to provide short-term relief, up to about 5 days. Typically, we tell patients 3 days, because it's important for patients to know, although they provide immense relief of nasal obstruction, they can lead to an entity called rhinitis medicamentosa, which can be very difficult to treat. Another medical strategy that I see vastly overused is antihistamines, because antihistamines are really useful in allergic rhinitis where patients complain of an itchy nose or itchy eyes, but they do not help with rhinorrhea and nasal obstruction and any kind of rhinitis. And nasal dilatation devices can be very useful in nasal valve collapse. And interestingly, most people, even those who do not have internal nasal valve collapse, will find that improves nasal airflow subjectively. However, they can be unsightly and they can cause skin excoriation. And most of the time, they're very useful for overnight symptoms. Sinus rinsing, which is a cornerstone of management in chronic sinusitis and also rhinitis, where postnasal drip is a predominant symptom, will provide good temporary relief as it will wash away some of the mucus. And we often use it postoperatively to help with healing. However, the kind of gold standard and cornerstone of treatment for both rhinitis and sinusitis is topical intranasal steroid. And this is the only medical treatment that is strongly evidence-based. And there are two main types available in New Zealand: fluticasone, which is usually branded as Flixonase, and budesonide, which is commonly branded as Stericlear. It doesn't matter too much which one is used. I personally prefer Flixonase because it has a higher first-pass hepatic clearance compared to the Stericlear, but they're very similar. And the main side effect associated with topical intranasal steroids is nasal crusting and bleeding. And if patients experience this, they need to stop for a couple of weeks to let their nose heal. Usually, I recommend a minimum of 4 weeks. And so with Flixonase, that's 2 sprays in the morning each side and 2 sprays in the evening each side, which is the maximum dose. And I wait for 4 weeks to see if that improves the symptoms. And then if it does, and the patient is happy with the state of their nose, they can start down titrating perhaps to 1 spray each side twice a day until they're happy with how their nose is. Anticholinergic sprays such as Atrovent can be helpful in vasomotor rhinitis, but as we mentioned before, this is not a common form of rhinitis like perineal. And in chronic sinusitis with polyposis, oral steroids are highly therapeutic. And in chronic sinusitis without polyposis, antibiotics, which are very commonly prescribed, only provide temporary benefit.
So thanks for that, Nick, talking about the conservative approach. I wonder if we can move briefly onto surgical management. When does surgery have a role to play?
I think the headline for this would be that surgery has a role where topical steroids have failed to improve patient symptoms. Surgery commonly involves a septoplasty and turbinoplasty. And when there is sinusitis, a FES. And FES, which stands for functional endoscopic sinus surgery, is also then performed. In both rhinitis and sinusitis, surgery has a twofold role. Firstly, it provides relief from nasal obstruction, which can be achieved mainly by the septoplasty and turbinoplasty component. And this is usually immediate. And secondly, which is most important, what it does is it provides room for the intranasal steroid spray to disperse inside the nose. Because the main reason that patients fail to improve on topical steroid therapy is that the large turbinates and sometimes the deviated septum blocks the spray from being able to disperse into the big area that is the sinonasal cavity. With the FES component, what we do there is we open up all the sinus groups to expose the inside mucosa, because the best way to think about sinuses, they're like very big rooms with very small doors. And so what we do is we remove a whole wall to allow penetration of the topical steroid into the sinus. And I always stress to patients that surgery is not a cure, but actually a means of alleviating nasal obstruction and allowing better penetration of topical steroid in the sinus rinses.
That's a really good point and something that our patients need to be aware of, and we need to be aware of as practitioners, that we need to continue those nasal steroids. So thank you for highlighting that. I wonder if we can just talk now about who needs to be referred on from primary care and what the threshold for referral would be.
For patients who have underlying rhinitis and sinusitis, so blocked nose, post-nasal drip, perhaps facial discomfort, I think a good threshold is if they've had a four-week trial of a topical steroid and they remain symptomatic, or the nose hasn't improved to a level that they would be happy with. For children who snore or have suspected sleep disorder breathing, I think the threshold should be very low, because increasingly there is agreement amongst ENT surgeons that any level of snoring that has parental concern requires treatment, because it likely represents an underlying impairment to the sleep architecture, which is so important for development. That's what I would say are the main thresholds for referral.
Yes, and I suppose then the red flag symptoms that you mentioned before would be high up there too.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Well, thank you for your time today. It's been fantastic talking to you and unpacking this a little bit. I wonder, to conclude our podcast, please, some take-home messages for our listeners.
So what I would say is having a good headlight to examine the anterior nasal cavity is really important. Realizing that rhinitis is incredibly common in New Zealand, probably up to a third of the population will have a form of it. Patients will often present with symptoms that are not a blocked nose, but the underlying problem is the blocked nose. Topical steroid therapy is the golden cornerstone of treatment, and surgery is a treatment of choice in patients who fail topical steroid treatment. Those would be my main take-home messages.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nick. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you for having me.
If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPD points, our podcasts are eligible for these. Also, you'll find a list of resources used on our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thank you for listening.